Welcome to the pod. Pat Forte, Pete Thamel, intrepid producer Sully here. Dan Wetzel is on vacation. And quite frankly, we already taped the podcast earlier today, but we are going back in with an emergency pod, new lead, thanks to the one and only, thank you, Mike Gundy. Our man, all mullet, no muscle, and not much brain power behind Coach Gundy. Amazing situation that flared up on Monday afternoon, Pete, with a picture of the Oklahoma State football coach on a fishing trip, very successful fishing trip, I'll say. They caught a lot of fish, wearing an OAN t-shirt. That is One America News Network, right-wing conspiracy factory that Gundy has championed before when it related to the coronavirus. Picture comes out on Twitter, raises eyebrows. People are like, wow, he's actually wearing the shirt. But that really set off an actual player revolt from current and former Oklahoma State players. And the important thing to say is current, where if you look at what happened at Iowa, which we'll get into later in the podcast, that was all former players basically unloading on strength coach Chris Doyle. This is current players. Chuba Hubbard, the leading rusher last year in college football, blowing up his coach on Twitter. Pete, what did he say?
Pat, he made it very clear. He said, I will not stand for this. This is completely insensitive to everything going on in society, and it's unacceptable. I will not be doing anything with Oklahoma State until things change, and change is in all capital letters.
Bam! Shot across the bow there. Pistols firing from Pistol Pete's best player, and then he was backed up. Chuba was then backed up by his teammates, linebacker Amen Ogbonbamiga, who led the team with 15 and a half tackles for loss last season. He quickly supported Hubbard on Twitter. I stand with him, he said. Senior offensive lineman Tevin Jenkins, who started 25 games the past 2 years. He's won a lot of team awards for being like a team first guy. As an O-line, we stand and support Chuba. And then the former players unloaded. And man, oh man, this thing got ugly quickly for Mike Gundy. How big a deal is this, Pete? Some people say, hey, it's just a t-shirt. But keep in mind, Mike Gundy actually once fired a contractor, a carpenter, because he wore an Oklahoma baseball t-shirt to his house to do some work. So the t-shirt karma has come back around on Mike. What? How bad is this, Pete?
I think it's really bad. And I think the important thing to just point out is Gundy can't like just fib his way out. Oh, I didn't know, et cetera, because amid his infamous coronavirus rant of about 6 weeks ago, he said, it's One America News. It was so refreshing. They just report the news. There's no commentary. There's no opinions. There's no left. There's no right. And basically, Mike Gundy has hung himself with his own words. He can't talk his way around this or out of this, because basically he believes that a network that has consistently criticized the Black Lives Matter movement, that has consistently spun right-wing conspiracy theories, like you said earlier, Pat, and has basically consistently gone to the far right of Fox News, the way far right of Fox News, is what he considers down the middle. Like, he thinks it's PBS. And yeah. So I really think that Mike Gundy, first of all, is guilty of zero self-awareness right now. Now, he's on a fishing trip. It wasn't like he was at a press conference, but he makes $5 million a year, or however much he does, as the head coach of Oklahoma State. And him actually putting that shirt on as a public figure was a giant mistake. And Mike Gundy has long lacked self-awareness, and he has also long lacked consequences. Because remember, after his coronavirus rant, he was not required to apologize. He released a somewhat trite statement and then just moved on. But Mike Gundy has always operated above his superiors. I mean, they made the golf coach the AD so Gundy could walk all over him. And, you know, with Boone Pickens gone, who had been a Gundy adversary for years, he's passed away. Gundy has really run with no governor. He has never had to be conscious of social issues, and he's never had to be conscious of how his team's felt because he's been able to run all over him. But the world has changed even since his coronavirus rant. And I think Mike Gundy is amid a situation, if only because he's so hard-headed, that I don't think he's going to realize how serious this is get in the fetal position and meet his players halfway and learn and grow and evolve and apologize and realize what he did. If you look at what happened at Iowa, Pat, like Kirk Ferentz was very aware of the seriousness of the situation right away and, you know, made that clear, brought in the players and really made a concerted and I think genuine effort to make change in that program. I am skeptical considering Mike Gundy's track record that he's willing to do that.
Sure. No, I mean, that's the thing. He, for all the reasons you said, A, he's never really had a boss who could make him do anything. And B, just that's not his mentality anyway. You know, yes, his apology off of the coronavirus thing was half-hearted at best. He is in a situation. This one is going to be tough to walk out of when your best players are coming at you hard and the former players are coming at you. I don't know that this is going to be an easy fix for him. The PR damage is immense. The loss of locker room, we'll see. Like at Florida State, there was a flare-up, but Mike Norvell got that under control quickly. This has the feeling of something very different thus far. We'll see where it goes. But that's the thing, is OAN is you are espousing for the second time publicly a network that is probably as antagonistic as could be towards something that's very important to a lot of your players. I mean, they said Black Lives Matter is a, quote, farce on the air, in addition to other, you know, rantings and criticisms of the Black Lives Matter movement. And if that's who you're championing, then you're dismissing your own players. You're out of touch with them, what they are thinking about, how they feel, what matters to them. And that's a heck of a lot to take on. And you pointed out, too, that Ferentz, and we're going to talk about it more later, the Iowa situation, but Ferentz was quick to listen, I think, and to get to a position where he needed to get in terms of understanding the anger that was going on towards his strength coach. Very interesting. I wanted to compare the Gundy t-shirt to another football coach who's been incredibly tone deaf in a controversial t-shirt recently, and that's Dabo Swinney, Clemson, wearing a shirt that said football matters. In that case, this is after Dabo had a couple of, I thought, failed attempts to connect with the Black Lives Matter situation, the police brutality situation in the United States. He was seen at a pool, similar situation to Gundy. He's on his own time. He's not at work. He's wearing a shirt that says football matters. That caught a lot of people askance, saying, wait a minute, is this a send up or a mockery of Black Lives Matter? Or what's he trying to do there? It turns out, Trevor Lawrence, his star quarterback, comes out quickly on Twitter and says, there's no statement there. Coach has been wearing that shirt around for months. It's a saying, it's a slogan that he's been dealing with about the importance of football for him and his players. And I think the difference in tone between one guy's star player coming out, I got your back, and the other guy's star player attacking the coach, and the responses thereafter shows one coach is in a lot better standing in his locker room than the other one.
That's 100% right, Pat. And here's a key differentiation between what's happening at Oklahoma State and what's happening at Iowa. If you look at what Elsie Greenwood said about Mike Gundy, and this is Elsie Greenwood, who was a kind of middling player who had announced recently he was going to transfer out of Oklahoma State. He had been a receiver and also played a little bit on the other side of the ball. He said, quote, I was called a hood rat and thug on multiple occasions, being threatened to be sent back home, all because of wearing a do-rag and sleeveless shirt. Now, he does not say necessarily Mike Gundy said that, but these accusations seem to hit a little bit more home to the head coach's office than they do in the Ferentz situation. And then another player, Pat Macon, said, at least he talked to you. He would pretend to be on the phone with someone when I see him in the hallway to avoid interacting with him. That was very uncomfortable. What Mike Gundy, I think, will have to do here, because he has clearly lost his star player and much of his locker room. Justice Hill speaking out against him, the former Oklahoma State player. Justice Hill's probably the best player in that program in the last 5 years, that comes to my mind anyway. There has been a very consistent echo, and there has been no one trying to put a stop to it publicly. I have not seen a single person stand up for Mike Gundy here. He has to show humility and introspection. And these are two qualities that I have never seen Mike Gundy show.
Yeah.
Ever. Ever.
I think you basically just said a frog has to grow wings and fly.
Yes.
I mean, I just don't know whether it's possible. Can it happen?
Yes. You know? That's like counting on a frog for your steak dinner.
Right. My Gundy's always been the smartest guy in the room. Kowtowed to no one, answered to no one. And yeah, this will be a real test of whether or not he has any of that within him. I mean, is there an ounce of introspection or accountability in him?
Yeah.
I don't know.
In a, you know, coaching profession that's filled with egomaniacs, Mike Gundy is particularly controlling. He's very limiting on who his players talk to in the media. Remember, obviously, the famous I'm a man, I'm 40 rant. That was about control and questioning the media, questioning one of his players. He's very, you know, they've been very limited on Twitter there. Like there's a lot of restrictions. Like there, you know, when you look at Iowa, there was wholesale changes made very quickly because the players stood up. It will be very interesting, and I've written about this in my column on Yahoo. Like the program at Oklahoma State this spring has been very geared around, according to people there, Gundy's son, who is now going to be an incoming freshman and is a quarterback. Like Gundy would be at practice, like all spring practices, sitting there talking to his son. So players have noticed that. That has not gone unnoticed. And Mike Gundy is not self-aware. This is one thing we all know. Like we could, I don't even think like the most vigilant Mike Gundy critic defenders. And there's really just one, the guy in Stillwater who does their radio, who will turn this. I can't wait to see the Saturday Night Live skit that turns into. But you know, if there's one thing about Mike Gundy, like he is not all of a sudden going to change, because you know, God bless him, he's been very successful. I mean, the football piece of what Mike Gundy has become, you cannot question. But the problem is the world has radically changed, even since his coronavirus rant, which you and I had very pointed opinions on last time. The world is radically different from that. And he didn't learn or change or evolve from that. And there is going to have to be some evolution, because pretty much the players have drawn a line in the sand. And they're daring Gundy to come, you know, meet them there or join them or dialogue with them. And I think some of this is a symptom of their dissatisfaction with his engagement in the program. So if he's not engaged with the players and he's out, you know, promoting a television network that spins that degrades the Black Lives Matters movement and spins right wing conspiracies and basically is a network that makes the Black population feel vulnerable. It makes the Black population feel like they are second class. I mean, that's essentially what that television network has been built on in a lot of ways. And so I really feel like this is a fascinating moment for the, you know, when you look at, I mean, this makes the Marvin Austin poop emoji look, you know, look very, very benign, right?
Absolutely.
Because,
yes.
Because this is going to go to the core of Mike Gundy and dare him to change. And I don't think you and I can sit here and say, oh, he'll change and evolve, because he never has.
So this is the gauntlet's been thrown down here. And interesting, I don't know if it's coincidence or if it's symptomatic of something here, Pete, but we're talking in particular here with Iowa and with Oklahoma State, programs that have had one guy in charge for a long time and has been very successful and able to do things exactly the way he has wanted to do them. Gundy, 129-64 at a place where if you're over 500, you're doing really well. And he's way over 500. He's double. He's 6'6", 7". The one thing, you know, he's had, I think, 5-10 win seasons. They had one year they almost played for the national championship. They blew a game against Iowa State. Yep, The only game they lost that year, they were 12-1. I think it was 2011, maybe. And other than that, I mean, but the only thing he hadn't done, he hadn't beaten Oklahoma. He's 2-13 against Oklahoma. But that's the thing. He has earned himself this stature and this status that I think has given him a feeling that he can say what he wants, he can do what he wants, and what's anybody going to do to me? And now we're going to find out.
And it's a great comparison with Iowa with the tenure. Those are also two weak athletic directors. Gary Barta and Mike Holder are not considered high-end athletic directors in college athletics. They are benign figures who really have had zero impact on the greater scheme of college sports. They're kind of caretakers who are just there. They're really non-factors. They're not. I don't want to say they're bad athletic directors, but they're certainly not regarded highly amongst their peers. They're just kind of they're just kind of there, and the coaches are definitely bigger than them. And this is going to be, honestly, a test of Oklahoma State administration, because Mike Holder isn't going to change Mike Gundy. He hasn't been able to do it for however long he's been there. This is really going to go up the food chain at Oklahoma State. And the real fascinating part for Gundy, and I wrote about this in my last column about him after the after his skepticism of the virus in that kind of epic rant. I don't know if Gundy's particularly employable in a lot of other places. Now, there'll be some bandit Conference USA school that'll go hire him. There'll always be someone desperate to win. That was before this era of player empowerment, though. I really think, other than Tennessee wanting to hire him, Gundy has limited his own opportunity by being himself. And so I really feel like if I'm Gundy, I'm looking at this like there's some urgency here. Because if I lose this job, I may not have abundance of opportunities because I'm being branded as an outlier who's insensitive to black players. And in the environment going forward, that's going to be really hard to get hired somewhere.
Okay. So it is June. We think the season's going to start on time. End of August, Labor Day weekend. Can you fire your 15-year head coach right now? And if so, how do you replace him? What do you do?
They would only fire him if, like, he refused to acknowledge change, if the social pressure from inside and outside got so strong. It will be interesting if they actually bring in an independent investigation. And again, we're taping just a couple hours after this happened. So when you look at Elsie Greenwood's comments and other racial comments, we don't know if there'll be a preponderance of them or only a handful. Now, they should investigate, even if there is only a handful. I don't want to dismiss that by any means. But the university, this is where, like, sports and politics and culture all collide, because Oklahoma State University is going to have zero interest in firing Mike Gundy. Zero interest at all. Like, it's just, it is not who they are. It's not what they want to do. I would imagine the fan base at Oklahoma State, and I'd be curious to hear from some of our listeners on Twitter if I'm misreading this, is standing behind Gundy on this. Like, my initial reaction that I got on Twitter, and again, Twitter is not a great indicator of real life, and I understand that, but it was a lot of like, if he was wearing an MSNBC t-shirt, what would people be saying? Like, there is an immediate urge to politicize this and fracture arguments, as opposed to having empathy for Chuba Hubbard, who clearly feels like his coach is perpetuating racist sentiment, and he's pissed off about it.
Yeah, no, I agree that they would not have the stomach for this unless Gundy doesn't make it easy, I would say. If he doesn't want to have any level of contrition or meet the players more than halfway or anything like that, then I think their hand will be forced. But it's not something they're going to want to do for sure. But I'm telling you now, on the flip side of that, If they are forced to make a choice, we keep Mike Gundy, or would you be shocked if Chuba Hubbard just says, hey, you know what? Maybe I shouldn't have even come back for this season anyway. A lot of people were surprised he didn't go to the NFL. I'll sit this one out. I'm a high draft pick prospect, and he might have some teammates that are thinking the same thing too. So
what about the supplemental draft, which still hasn't happened? Supplemental draft is a really weird organism. Like there's no date set for it, because, you know, we all looked into it a little bit during mm-hmm. the pandemic for guys like Sean Wade who came back, guys like Chuba Hubbard who came back. Like, if there was no season, could we do that? That was like a March topic. And the one thing about this supplemental draft is, like, it's a very ambiguous entity. So yeah. I can't sit here and tell you this would or would not fall. It's usually for guys who fail out, have drug tests, but, like, the NFL, where it is with race relations right now, if Chuba Hubbard comes to them and says, I think my coach is racist, I don't want to play for him, I think that's a pretty compelling argument, and one that the NFL, where it is PR wise, would not want to lose.
Yeah, because I think the NFL has said they really didn't want to open up the supplemental draft to pandemic related entries, but this is a different matter.
I could be dead wrong on that. I want to be clear about it. Like, I have no idea, but I just think from a PR perspective, I have no idea, like, what the letter of the law of the supplemental draft is. It's a strange organization, that it's a strange entity that has very, you know, there seems very little formal about it, including the date. Like, I blew my mind in April that there was no date set for the supplemental draft, but it's for, like, right. Like, for example, Sam Beal from Western Michigan failed out of there a couple years ago. He ended up going in the supplemental draft. Like, that's who it's designed for, guys who can't play for, you know, for a specific reason like that. But here's the other thing, too. If you're Chuba Hubbard and you want to start a revolution, I bet the NCAA would clear him for a hardship situation in a split second. Hey, you want to go to, you know, again, these places have running backs. You want to go to Ohio State, which took a, you know, which took Trey Sermon last year because they needed a tailback. You want to go to, you know, Clemson obviously has a really good tailback. But, you know, if like Texas, for example, does not have a great, they do not have a ton of tailback depth right now. Mm-hmm. If you're, or you want to go to USC, I'm just thinking of places that maybe don't have a, or Florida State, for example, Pat, you said, you know, we talked about, we'll talk about a little later in the podcast. Like they don't have a, they don't have a thumper tailback. Like I can't fathom the NCAA in this climate, not granting him immediate eligibility. It would be, it'd be stunning. And even if you look at the Justin Fields ruling from last year and the racial ties to that. And that was pretty easy to pass. I think Tom Mars could eat that like an appetizer. That's easy work for him.
Yeah, no, that will be really interesting to watch. Is A, you know, does Gundy keep his job? B, does he keep his players? You know, or do these guys that are, I mean, very high level players hit the bricks and try to get out of there? And if so, do they try to transfer or do they just sit out and say, I'm going to play for the, or train for the NFL draft? Either way, what is guaranteed to be an ongoing saga in Stillwater. Yes. Very interesting. And we will be watching this and we'll do another pod this week. And I'm sure this will be part of it.
Yeah. Well, I don't think in this ongoing saga, we're going to get that Eskimo Joe's sponsorship that we've been seeking, which is a bummer for all of us.
It is. Hey, good bar in Stillwater, Eskimo Joe's, by golly. Been there. Hope to be there again someday. But okay, back to our regularly scheduled pod and our very compelling reason why it might be the last pod ever. Listen up. Welcome to the show. Sorry to tell you guys, it looks like this is probably going to be our last show because in case you haven't heard, the world is ending this week. So hate to break. I hope we're not the ones breaking it to you. But if we are, that's a pretty good scoop for us. Settle all your affairs. Take care of your business. Kiss your loved ones goodbye. But the Mayan calendar apparently was read incorrectly. You may remember that said the world was going to end on December 21st, 2012. That was the prophecy. Came and went. Everybody lived. But now there's news reports that the calendar was misread, miscalculated. The new calculation, according to the Sun, the very reliable news source, the British tabloid, the Sun, is that the world's like ending now, like any day this week. So that's your news update. And, I'm sorry, maybe we'll be able to do the show in the next world, in the afterlife. Myself, I am here with Pete Thamel. Dan Wetzel, apparently realizing the world was coming to an end, hightailed it to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And I guess, Pete, if you're gonna go, you might as well go in a cabin up there on the UP. I don't know. We'll tell Dan a fond goodbye, but... I'm sorry that we got to go out this way.
If you are heading to the Traverse City, Michigan area this week, just be prepared for the lack of Bud Light in your local, community liquor store. Oh, what did I say? I said Bud Light. My God. Boy.
Dan's going to sue you for that.
I know. I'm ruining his brand, his long plotted courtship for the Busch Light sponsorship. The only person in America pursuing a Busch Light sponsorship, Dan Wetzel. Yes, he did send us on our group text a picture of a 12 pack in ice on on a lake as he was grilling meat. So good for Dan for beating the Mayan death posse, taking some time off and enjoying some of his beloved swill for these last precious moments on this earth.
Yeah. So that's where Wetzel's going to meet his maker up on the UP. Pete's, in various undisclosed whereabouts in Massachusetts. I'm in Louisville, Kentucky. Sully, the dogged producer, is in SoCal. Goodbye to everyone. But on the very slim chance, that we survive this and we do have further podcasts and we do have more news and everything like that, we will finish the show. We'll go ahead and give you guys the rest of the news out there. And it will be, this is going to be actually a little bit more football-centric show because Wetzel isn't around to just take things off the rails because he refuses to drill down on the details of anything. So we are going to get into a, we're going to talk a little bit about, we're going to do a kind of an overview of a conference. We're going to do the ACC, talk about the league as we see it, the way it's been the last few years and what we think is going to happen in 2020. But before we do that, we got a few other updates, news and notes, things happening out there. Pete, let's start with the news out of Iowa that broke shortly before we started taping here. Chris Doyle separation agreement with Iowa. Nobody can ever just be fired these days. It has to be a separation agreement. So I think Gary Barta will be talking about it later today, but the news broke already about Doyle being out. Not a big surprise, I don't think, to anybody. Doyle has been the strength coach, right-hand man of Kirk Ferentz for his entire tenure there, going back to the 1990s. Doyle was the one who former players came out from all over the place to criticize recently for what I guess you would say at best was racial insensitivity, if not outright racism, bullying, degrading players, particularly black players. And he was suspended last week and his tenure is over as of today. What are your initial thoughts there, Pete?
Yeah, this was completely predictable. The surprises probably didn't happen sooner. There was a due process. I thought Kirk Ferentz would announce this at his press conference last week. Chris Doyle had next to 0% chance of surviving. The way I read the, you know, I think over 50 players came out and spoke up. And it was essentially fostering an environment of racial degradation. That was probably the best way to put it, where the word ghetto, for example, was used. And there were just different terms. I mean, I was blown away, Pat, that they couldn't wear hoodies in their facility
right
until recently. Like there were just some backwards things happening at Iowa football that give Kirk Ferentz credit that he has now recognized he needs to change immediately. And I think publicly he has handled everything well. The separation of Chris Doyle was obvious. The signs were on the wall from his suspension to his son, who was a promising young linebacker, entering the transfer portal. Those signs were happening. I think almost the most significant thing about today's news was that it was just Chris Doyle. There were no assistant coaches. There was no one else on the staff that we've been made aware of publicly that is going to have any type of tangible reverberations. Now, I do think that at the very least, there's going to be a lot of sensitivity training. Like, you just can't let Chris Doyle go and let everybody march on their merry way in Iowa, I would think, at this point, with the scrutiny they're under and with what accusations have emerged from those former players. I do think as an entire staff, there is going to be some type of educational mechanism put in here for Iowa moving forward and pushing forward at the very least, if nothing else, punitive.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. That then the one thing that is somewhat, I think, troubling is Chris Doyle apparently gets $1.1 million out of this separation agreement. I'm not sure that's a great signal about how Iowa handled this. Now, I mean, obviously, look, it is difficult to make people go away these days, but $1.1 million to be ushered out of a job where you were bullying players for two decades, I don't know. That's, it's one thing to get a buyout because you were losing games. It's I'm not sure about the buyout there. But
that is a buyout to avoid court, because if they tried to take Chris Doyle's money that was left on his contract, Kirk Ferentz would have been deposed. The whole staff, they would have trotted up all the former players on the stand. And that is $1.1 million to avoid a spectacle. I am not defending it, but that is clearly what Iowa was doing and thinking. And, let's not undersell the relationship piece of this here. Like, Chris Doyle has made, he has been the bedrock of Kirk Ferentz's career. Like, there have to be a lot of tight personal relationships here. And, at Kirk Ferentz's core, he's going to want his guy taken care of on the way out the door. Now, I'm not saying he told them to do that or he did that, but I can't see Iowa fighting on principle to keep the $1.1 million. I think they thank him for his 20 years and what he's helped build there within the program, and they give him the money, and they're doing this to clearly avoid headaches and, you know, what could be weeks and months of more bad headlines.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. That, I mean, I think that you're exactly right that that's what that money is there for. And yeah, I mean, sure, Kirk Ferentz, probably, you know, who knows whether Kirk needed any sort of convincing that this needed to happen or not. But, I mean, Doyle was, as you said, he was his right-hand guy. I mean, strength coach is hugely important everywhere these days. He was getting paid $800,000, you know, paid like a rock star. And he was running his part of the program the way Kirk Ferentz wanted him to run his part of the program. Maybe Kirk didn't know every bullying detail, but, you know, he wanted the tough guy, the old school, more and more archaic, less and less tolerable strength coach as punisher guy in there, you know, to beat him up, break him down, and then build him back up into champions. That's you know, there's been a lot of that out there for a lot of years, but that's a tougher and tougher sell, I think, these days. And coaches that, if that's your guy, you better watch out. You know, we saw it go to a tragic degree at Maryland a couple of years ago. This obviously hasn't been like anything like to that extent. Nobody's lost their life in Iowa. But, you know, that whole mentality, I think, is on its way out. Otherwise, Pete, here, do you feel like Kirk Ferentz is okay going forward in his position?
Yeah, I think the universe, just allowing him to talk like he did with the three players in that press conference on BTN on, well, it was broadcast on BTN. I watched it on BTN on Friday. Others could have watched it many other places. Giving Kirk Ferentz the forum voice, players are back now, Kirk's in charge. So I don't, unless some skeletons really come up about Kirk in the investigation that haven't popped up from the players, I would think Kirk Ferentz returns to Iowa for next season and beyond. I mean, I do believe he has a $1.3 billion buyout on his contract through 2072. Is that right? Do I have the right details on that?
$1.3 billion, yes, absolutely.
Yes, I think it's 2072. It might be through 2076. Yeah. I'm going to have to check our FOIA records, but I think that is the amount of guarantee on Kirk Ferentz's contract. So I could be wrong. But honestly, one of the reasons why the conservative state of Iowa gave Kirk Ferentz that deal and essentially took like the gross national product of the state's corn syrup production and tied it to his salary is because he was like the most controversy-free guy in all of college football. Mm-hmm. He's you've dealt with Kirk Ferentz. I've dealt with Kirk Ferentz. He's a gentleman and he's somewhat benign, like a very nice guy, a very warm, engaging guy. But like, think of the last controversial Kirk Ferentz thing that's happened.
The only thing was Chris Doyle when he put the 13 rhabdo players in the hospital with rhabdo in 2011, I think it was. But yeah, no, you're right. Is that's Kirk Ferentz in Iowa are match made in heaven, as you said. Yes. You know, a relatively conservative place where it is not that, you know, the whole program is, it's not loud, it's not outlandish, it's, you know, it is said steady and solid and all the things that Kirk Ferentz is. So you're right. And yes, a deft nod to perhaps the most egregious contract anybody got in college football is the the Kirk Ferentz deal. Just has been mind boggling for years. Right. So let's talk about the latest in the players returning to campus situation. And Houston has actually shut down their return game. They're suspending on-campus workouts for its athletes after six of them tested positive for the coronavirus. They announced that suspension Friday afternoon. Houston has been a hotspot for positive tests in recent days and weeks. And this is a school that Houston was of the volition at first that they were only going to test people if they were symptomatic. One of those kind of wait and see if it bites us sort of things, and it bit them. Pete, what's the level of concern there at Houston, and when will they be able to piece things back together?
I think the level of concern has to be extreme. If you are an athletic director and you signed off on we're not testing, I mean, you might as well just take your career and throw it in a river. Like, I mean, that has to be the single dumbest administrative thing in modern college athletics. Hey, let's not test. Now, I've had ADs explain to me that, like, their president's office has recommended they not test because they don't want it to be – they don't want the athletic department or athletes to look like they're different from the regular students if they're not going to test all the regular students coming back, which would obviously be a massive thing. But the reason why you test is very simple. It's what happened at Houston. So when everyone gets the coronavirus, you're not like, oh, my God. No, we didn't test. And you look like absolute morons. And give the Houston area media, the Chronicle included, you know, give them credit for first guessing this.
Yeah.
They didn't like second guess it. They right. had experts on the record in the newspaper. And, you know, Tillman Fertitta, the Rockets owner, who is the super booster at Houston and is basically like uses the Houston football program as like his fantasy team. He is down hundreds of millions of dollars in this because he owns restaurants and he owns casinos and all that stuff. And Houston is financially in pretty dire straits, just as they are like all AAC programs spending like they're in a major conference, but not bringing in revenue like they're in a major conference. And I just wonder how much Houston's perilous financial situation led them to this. These tests, like I've had ADs tell me that they're putting $1.5 million, $2 million in line nine budgets at a time when they're not making any income and they're planning on making exponentially less. But please God, athletic directors, don't give the student athletes health the short shift here. Like figure something else out. Turn off the waterfall in your locker room. Stop building your practice facility. Do something else. Like, it is the most tone-deaf, ridiculous thing to not test the athletes. Like, I even saw something on Twitter today where basketball testing, maybe, like, bunches. We're only going to test five guys. Well, guess what? If one of the other five gets it, they're all going to have it by the end of the first day of pickup. So, like, at the very least, do it to cover your own tails, right? Like, just from a CYA perspective, testing just should be baseline and should be frequent. Figure out a way to pay for it.
Yeah, that's to me. It's like that's one thing you cannot go cheap on and you cannot roll the dice to say, yeah, we'll probably be OK. I just that should be non-negotiable first step for every athlete that comes back. And yes, I do agree. It does present a problem where why are the athletes doing it, but you don't care about the other students? Well, first of all, you are asking more of the athletes in terms of coming back earlier and being on campus solely to work out for their sports because there's no campus classes. So you are basically putting them out there to be the guinea pigs of how this thing's going to go when you bring back campus, full student body. So I think to not pretest and have that all the box checked and just purely for the liability standpoint, I just thought was a very, very bad idea. That could only have a bad result. I mean, if you have a good result, nobody notices. If you have a bad result, everybody really notices. And so now Houston's on the hook for that.
Do you really like, can you imagine that staff meeting where that like, you know, seemingly smart, well-compensated people were sitting in a room saying, yeah, let's not test for the coronavirus. And by the way, this happens at a time when the city of Houston, as we know, our friend and coworker Charles Robinson lives there. And, it's just kind of like we're all sitting around chatting about how the virus is affecting us day to day. Houston is getting pummeled right now.
Right.
Houston is mid-second wave right now. Mm-hmm. The opening up in Houston, as in a lot of Texas, has gone extremely poorly. Read the room, protect your athletes, and figure out a way to get the money. Like, I'd love to have some, like, video of that staff meeting where they figured that out. That would be some, like, there you talk about, like, the paragon of leadership in college athletics. Like, Chris Pesman and his crew said, like, nah, we don't need the test. We're good.
No, I know. It's kind of a remarkable conclusion to arrive at. It really is. And, I mean, I remember talking to a few ADs, you know, gosh, I guess it was a month ago. It seems like it was 4 years ago now. Things it both happened very quickly and very slowly. And they were like, ooh, we were finding out how much this is going to cost. Wow, this is going to be pretty expensive. It's like, yeah, of course it's going to be expensive. And you need to be prepared to do it. And yes, I understand. And as you noted, it's a big added expense at a time when you are losing revenue. So it's not an easy pill to swallow. But to me, it's a non-negotiable pill to swallow. You got to do it. And here's the result of not doing it. In other coronavirus-related return-to-campus news, Ohio State had athletes sign something called the Buckeye Pledge. I'm going to let you describe it a little bit more because I think that you have read the actual document, which I have not, I admit. But it's asking players to, quote, pledge to take responsibility for my own health and help stop the spread of the COVID-19. Pete, what exactly is the document and what does it mean?
So this is how I read the document. I'm looking at it right now here on my phone. It basically is like, you know, in the movies when like the high school football team all sign a pledge to like not drink for the whole season or smoke cigarettes and whatever. Like, yeah. Again, it's the coronavirus version of that. And that's the way I read it. We agree to testing. I agree to self-quarantine if I have symptoms. And basically, like, stay at home if I'm sick, wear a mask, practice physical distancing, wash my hands, keep personal space. And what's not said there is not be an idiot, like not go out to the bars, not go to parties, not put myself, my teammates, my coaches, you know, like Greg Madison would fit at Ohio State, the assistant would fit in that age range where he would be maybe more susceptible than others. I'm sure there are others there, but Greg comes to front of mind. Obviously, you know, Greg Madison, Pat, the veteran assistant who was at Michigan, Florida, Baltimore Ravens, bunch of other places. Like, and this is for these players' own parents and grandparents, et cetera, who may fall in that higher risk category. Like, so that was
Larry Johnson Sr., but Larry Johnson Sr., defensive line coach, is 67, 68 as well. So,
No, exactly. So to me, this wasn't like a waiver. I signed my life away to go play for the Buckeyes. It was more like I'm not going to go be an idiot and compromise my teammates, coaches, family's health and season. But actually talked to some people at Ohio State this morning. Like, there hasn't been big pushback from the players. Like, I think legal Twitter got all a flutter on this. But if you really read the document, I don't really think they're, like, signing anything away.
Mike, did the coaches sign it?
I don't know that. That is a good question. The document itself says student athlete electronic signature.
Okay.
So my hunch would be no.
Yeah. If I were going to be the locker room lawyer player, I think that might be my suggestion. It's like, we're signing this. How about anybody want to join us? Coaches, let's see you guys jump in with us here. Come on. Instead, opposed to coaches telling players you must or not, you must, but you need to sign this document. But I do believe they had 100% participation in this. So, yeah, there hasn't been any notable pushback. But, you know, that you mentioned, I mean, the coaches are certainly the ones that are theoretically more at risk here. And, you know, whether it's technically the exact same document or something similar, I would have liked to have seen them pledge to lead a healthy, safe, socially responsible football season existence as well.
Yeah. And the esteemed D1 ticker this morning, which I know you're a fan of, Pat, Indiana also reportedly signed a similar document to this, which I thought was interesting. And, you know, look, my theory on this season is that it's sort of going to be a survival of attrition, right? I was talking to a coach the other day who was like, well, if one of my running backs gets this during a game week, there's a really good chance the rest of my running backs are going to get this during a game week because they're going to be in the same running back room and they're going to be changing next to each other in the locker room, etc. So, like, the teams that can basically, like, stay home and play video games together and not go out and put their teammates at risk are going to have a much better chance of surviving the season. Like, I am fully convinced, and somebody can play this sound on the eve of the national title game and mock me to death, but I'm fully convinced we're going to have teams that are going to have to forfeit games this year. Like, I don't see how we don't. Or if not forfeit, like, play with defensive linemen playing offensive line or whatever it is, or people playing out of position. Like, there are going to be chunks of teams that are wiped out, and they're going to be difficult coach decisions, there are going to be difficult administrative decisions, especially with the dollars that are so desperately needed, as we were talking about at length. I've said it all along. It's not going to be clean. It's going to be messy. It's not going to be linear. And, you know, these are the types of situations that we're now looking at. And, you know, if Houston football has to shut down a week or two in, and that could be directly related to not testing and not tracing, like, it's just hard to imagine especially as the numbers increase in that SEC footprint in Texas, in different places that have opened back up, it's just hard to not imagine the virus impacting these teams.
And that's the thing. I mean, the numbers, it's just very interesting. You're right. The Sun Belt, you know, from Florida, Georgia, through the Gulf Coast, Texas, and then, boy, Arizona. Ooh, bad numbers in Arizona. California going way up. And then the question is going to be, which we have discussed before and we'll have to further discuss, you know, later, is what's the threshold? What's the tolerance level for, okay, we can deal with five guys test positive or if 10, if it gets to 20, what do we do? You know, and then, as you said, is it a forfeit or what level does it have to be to a forfeit, or is it a no contest and nobody gets, you know, a win or a loss? I mean, all these things. We'll obviously we'll talk about that as we get closer to actual games. But it's going to be so interesting, I think, to see just kind of A, first, where are the outbreaks? And then just B, how are they handled and what's the response? So that's
and what if you have a conference game canceled?
Yeah.
And then you're 6-1 in conference and someone is 7-1 in conference. And there's like, I mean, there's like a million different things. If you know, the we've been using Nebraska and Rutgers on the pod in the past because of the extremities and cases there. So if your Rutgers game gets canceled, can you replace them with, you know, some team that has a bye that week that wants $2 million? Like, I don't know. It's, you know, or like if you're not in the conference title game, can you play it that week in December to, for the Patriots? I'm not sure, but there is there's
a lot of permutations.
Anyone who just celebrated the return of players to campus and the new practice schedule without thinking of all the potential negative reverberations and situations that can happen. I know, you know, talking to ADs this morning, they're on pins and needles.
Oh yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
They're not. You know, this whole season is going to be played out on a high wire.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point. You'd hate to lose the Rutgers game, by the way, because that's an easy W. So
yes,
you want to play that game.
Maybe not for Nebraska though.
Yeah, right. Last virus related note: Gary Patterson, coach of the TCU Horned Frogs, and a guy who I wasn't sure there was a whole lot to GP beyond dialing up blitz packages. You know, I mean, he just seemed like such a football guy. But one of the things he did with his quarantine time was to record a country song. What's the title of this thing, Sully?
Right, it's called Take a Step Back. And according to our friend Bruce Feldman on Twitter, it's been a busy couple months for Gary Patterson. He wrote this thing back in April and recorded in May, and now it's hitting our airwaves on Twitter.
Take a Step Back. That's it. Okay. So let's spin. You want to play us 30 seconds of it, Sully? Okay, there we go. Little Gary Patterson, Take a Step Back. I got to give him credit. A nice Texas twanger there, you know? I mean, it's good Texas country. What do you think, Pete? Should he just hang up the coaching britches that he likes to hike up and go to Nashville, become a country star?
Well, if they're not any better than they were last year, he may have to. Yeah, so I'm like the worst guy to ask about country music because I like live in the Northeast and I have like zero country in my repertoire. So yeah, good little twang, as you said. And look, on the potential of like embarrassment that could come with a coach releasing a song, I think there's like very little potential for embarrassment here. Like when I heard Gary Patterson release a song, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be an epic disaster. It is not that. And that's about as close to a music critic as I'm going to get. Yes.
I like it. I give him credit. Again, he surprised me. I just didn't think he had it in him. Who would you say is the least likely coach to cut a song, quarantine song or otherwise? the last of the 130.
To distract while I'm thinking, I'm going to let our listeners know that Pat had not seen the movie Almost Famous until I mailed him the DVD of it from Amazon at some point during the quarantine or in the last 6 months. And he just received a copy of Almost Famous and didn't know where it came from. And Pat quite enjoyed it, didn't he?
I did. It was a very good song, a very good movie. I did enjoy it. That's, you know, that's it for my one movie every couple of months, 3 months, whatever. It's good.
So I'm going to say America's least likely country music star would be Paul Christ. Because he just think about Paul Christ. Paul Christ couldn't even do karaoke. So I would just think the epitome of endearing, bland Paul Christ would have a difficult time. Who do you think, Pat?
Yeah, I mean, I got to go Saban just because he's, you know, they get the chances of getting Saban to do anything frivolous like that are 0.0%. So, could you imagine just going up and asking Nick, hey, Nick, sing a little. You're like, what? Get out of my office. You know, it's not happening. So, okay. State of the conference, ACC. Pete, it's Clemson and a bunch of others. Do you see anything possible that is going to change that? That's the way it's been for at least 5 years, really ever since Jameis Winston left Tallahassee. That is the way it has been. Is anything going to disrupt the Clemson reign of terror in the ACC?
Other than the coronavirus?
Yeah, that'd be about it.
That would be about it. I don't know right now who I would pick for second place in the ACC, be it in Clemson's division or to you know, obviously play them in the league title game. North Carolina has a lot of buzz, but they returned obviously quarterback Sam Howell, who could be the type of player who a program gets built around, where later in his career the program could be lifted up. But they returned very little on the offensive line at North Carolina. They do have pretty much all their skill back at tailback and in receiver. But I just don't think defensively, they're, even though they played Clemson better than anyone really last year in the ACC, I don't really feel like they are at a pound-for-pound talent place to compete with them yet. And I do think some of the new coach buzz is going to fade there a little bit. They have Auburn early. They have UCF early, which I think will both be losses for them. How does North Carolina respond to that? You know, they've obviously recruited well, but those returns really won't be seen for a little while. And then Virginia Tech, I think, is really interesting, Pat, as another potential foil. They've certainly kind of just careened from ACC contention the past few years. And I really think the most interesting guy there is Justin Hamilton, who essentially was like brought in an off-the-field personnel role 2 years ago, and now he's the defensive coordinator. And that defense, obviously, especially early last season, opposition had their way with. You're bringing in a guy who's really, really green to run that defense. And Bud Foster, the end of his career, obviously, you think about that Duke game on the Friday night last year, did not match the results of the previous 30, but like Bud Foster knew how to find answers, and Bud Foster generally knew what he was doing. He may be a Hall of Fame assistant coach. He's certainly a Hall of Fame caliber assistant coach. So I've always thought Justin Fuente, his staff was maybe not of the caliber of the staffs of places in the ACC. When you look at like Florida State, when you look at Carolina, when you look at Clemson, I really think that is going to be the key staff hire in the ACC this year to dictate which direction Virginia Tech goes in.
No, good intel there on the staff. I quite frankly had totally forgotten who they had hired to replace Bud Foster, but
I was actually going to ask you that my notes here, and I forgot. So good thing I did not put you on the spot.
Thank you. Yes. No, you did. You did.
I may ask you to sing Country Roads before the pod is over too.
That isn't happening. I like North Carolina. I do. I am high on them. You're right. The schedule is tough immediately at UCF and then Auburn, neutral site in Atlanta.
Ain't so neutral.
Yeah, right. But after that, even if they lose those, I think they can win the Coastal, because the Coastal is not the Coastal Elite. It is just the Coastal.
No. And
their role is to provide cannon fodder for Clemson in the championship game in Charlotte. And they, as they have done with a rotating cast every single year. But I literally
every single year.
Yeah. They got Chaz Surratt at linebacker. I think he's a blossoming star for them. And Sam Howell's a blossoming star on offense. They do have all the skill back, as you noted. They did the left side of their line. They're rebuilding defense. They also have the estimable Storm Duck at cornerback. One of the great names in college football. So go.
There was a duck at Heels. App State last year who left early. I don't think he got drafted. I wonder if the ducks are brothers.
Might be. There might be a whole flock of ducks out there playing college football. I don't know.
Is it a flock or is it
I don't know, a pyramid? Oh, that was, you know, we touched on all that in a previous podcast on the various names for animals, animal groupings. My daughter came up with a website that had the whole list of them that was just phenomenal. I mean, just completely ridiculous names from that originated from like the 1600s. I won't even ask her. There was a parliament of something, like a parliament of hens or something. I can't remember what. But
yes.
One quick note on Virginia Tech, their defense, according to the magazine I'm looking at, a lot of guys coming back doesn't mean they're good because they were bad last year, but they're all juniors and seniors on that side of the ball. So experience at least. So they got some guys coming back. And Hendon Hooker, I thought, showed some real promise at quarterback. See if he continues to develop.
Before we dive into the other pretenders in the ACC, I'm just curious, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners fall in the same wheelhouse. What magazine do you have, Pat? Because I'm on the cusp of my magazine purchasing phase, but I'm waiting for stores to open up a little bit here in Massachusetts. I like to go buy them. I don't want to order my magazines online. It's like a moment. I usually wait till the 4th of July to do it, but we're going to be doing some league previews on the pod. So I'm curious what you have and if you have any magazine buying advice, what to buy, what to avoid, because some of them end up being pretty flimsy.
Yeah, no, great question. Great point. Usually, here's how I usually do it, is I sit there and wait for Phil Steele to come. And that one does come in the mail, and that's usually mid-June. Or so, and that's my go-to. And sometimes I buy the others, but sometimes I don't because Phil Steele's so good. But Phil, this year is
your man crush on Phil Steele has been well documented on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It is a long slow dance to In Your Eyes.
I wrote a column when I was at the Courier Journal about like Phil Steele is the most important person in my life starting Labor Day weekend, really starting August 1st and going forward for like 3 months. But so Phil Steele. But I got to wait for that now because that one is mail order. It's not going to be on newsstands and can't get that till July. So today, this morning, I went to go to Barnes & Noble, the closest bookstore here, to buy my mags. And first of all, I get there at 10:15. They don't open till 10:30, different hours. Okay, so I go run a couple other errands. I come back. All they have is baseball magazines. I'm like, what are you doing to me? What are you doing to me?
So well, is it a little early? Like that's why I asked a little bit.
No, I mean usually like, June, like Memorial Weekend is when they start hitting. So I'm outraged.
Yeah, sporting news is usually pretty good, but like it's in the past couple of years. But I don't know if that's been folded into something else now.
Yeah, I haven't seen sporting news for a couple of years.
So what do you
now.
Have? What do you? I've got.
I went to Kroger then, and I got Athlon, I got Lindy's, and I got Street and Smith's.
Okay, I usually buy those three as well.
Yeah, Athlon is the thickest one. I really, quite frankly, haven't opened the other two yet. String Smiths, I used to have a committed relationship with them when I was a kid, like because they had all the schedules in the back, and I would go through and pick every single game. I was not well, but that was my childhood.
Well, like you still aren't well, by the way.
So that's true.
But like in August, do you still fill out your Phil Steele the score of every team in every game?
I start usually, and then by the end of September, I'm tired of it, and I don't do it anymore.
Okay.
So, no. You know, that internet, it's amazing. It's all right there for you.
Pat realized that like 10 years after everybody else, so that's that's good. Just like Pat refused for about a five-year span to use GPS. Like when we all bought Garmins because we're on the road all the time, Pat refused to buy a Garmin. He was like, I got a map. I need a Garmin.
Fine. I could still make that fly. I really could.
Pat was also late to Uber, but that's another story for another time.
Uber, schmoober, whatever. all right. Pete, who's the second best team in the Atlantic behind Clemson? Is it going to be Florida State? Is it going to be Louisville? Or is it going to be somebody else that jumps up?
It's interesting, right? Because it's not easy to do what Scott Satterfield did there and take a horrific team and make them decent, right? And he did a wonderful job. but it's much harder to go from like decent to excellent than from horrible to good. Do you agree with that? Just yep. generally, like yep. you know, like you can do some very basic things within your program in terms of getting guys engaged, getting guys going. I mean, Bobby Petrino just basically stopped showing up at work in his last year at Louisville, and his staff was basically all relatives and like people who like caddied for him at the country club at some point in his life. Like it was just, it was a complete, like, I want to see the 30 for 30 on the end of the Bobby Petrino. There could be a great 30 for 30 on the, all of Bobby Petrino's endings.
Yeah.
All right. Right? Yeah. If you do the ending at Louisville, the ending at, well, the ending at Auburn, sure. near ending at Auburn, right. ending at Auburn, ending at Louisville, ending at the Falcons, ending at Arkansas, obviously. And then the ending at Louisville where he just gave up.
Yeah.
And Lamar Jackson covered a lot of sins. Lamar was gone. And then all of a sudden they were just a complete unmotivated train wreck. Like they just stopped tackling. I mean, it was a complete embarrassment what had happened there. So good on Scott Satterfield. He hired a great staff. He really energized that place, got it going. They still ranked, I believe, like 108th in total defense last year, which was a 20 place improvement.
Yeah.
So there's a long way to go. I just wonder if now the roster has atrophied to where they're able to take advantage of some good veteran players who were motivated at the tail end of their career. But now the roster is just going to be bottom heavy and is going to take some time to grow up. They have good skill at quarterback. They have good skill at receiver. They have Tutu Atwell. And that just makes me happy to say. Feels like football's back. It's like Storm Duck's great name cousin. I just feel like in my gut that Florida State under Mike Norvell, I'd feel better about this if they actually, you know, held 15 spring practices and could see each other once in a while. But I do feel like Blackman had shown some signs early in his career. Like the ultimate litmus test for Mike Norvell will be the degree of offensive side of the ball negligence that Willie Taggart was committing basically at Florida State. I think Mike Norvell is one of the bright young offensive minds in all of football. And I do think the insertion of his scheme, bringing in Kenny Dillingham as the OC, bringing in a scheme that clearly worked at Memphis in a lot of different ways. Like they had a lot of success running the ball. They had a lot of success passing the ball when the quarterback dictated it. They did a lot of things well, which to me, Mike Norvell's track record shows that he can tailor his system, which is going to be kind of more pro style there at Florida State, to the talent he has given. And you can't tell me there's no talent at Florida State. Like pound for pound, the Florida State roster is better than the Louisville roster. So that's where I'm going to end up on that. I'm going to bet on Norvell there, but a lot of that is going to come down to Blackman and what he can get out of Blackman, and the results are uneven at best right now.
Yeah. I think that Florida State should get the boost that Louisville got for the reason you said, that all of a sudden you got a coach that's competent and knows what they're doing more. You know, Louisville is just complete apathy, and they at least the coaching staff cared and coached them up. Florida State's going to be, I think, a coaching staff that didn't know what they're doing to a coaching staff that does know what they're doing, and that immediately should make them two or three games better for sure. And then, yeah, Blackman, I like Norvell's ability to build an offense. And as you said, they have talent there. They have players. Now, they don't have a proven running back. Cam Akers took almost every carry for like 14 years there, and he's gone now. They do have some proven receivers that they can work with. He will get, I think, the best out of Blackman. So I give them a chance there. And then defensively, they're going to have dudes. Louisville, I like the skill, but again, yeah, I don't know how much better they can get. Again, you know, can they take another big step forward? I'm not sure. They lost a left tackle who was as good as anybody in the country with good left tackles in a year of good left tackles in Mekhi Becton. I think he's going to be an NFL star. Defensively, they wallpapered over some deficiencies. We'll see how good they are on that side there, but the big game, October 24th, Florida State is at Louisville. And I think that's to decide who's the second best team in the division, in the Atlantic, and probably in the whole conference, I think. I think those are your – well, we'll see. North Carolina could sneak in there. All right, Petey, beyond those teams, anybody else you like, any surprise team that could move up in either division?
Well, I'll go a little bit local here because some of my inherent regional biases give me a preponderance of information on some of my teams up here. So, like, I was reading, because I don't have the luxury of buying magazines at Kroger right now during our state of the pandemic. I was reading a CBS Sportsline preview of the ACC earlier today, and they had Syracuse winless in the ACC, and I was going, wow. And they had BC 1-7 in the ACC, with its only win being over Syracuse. I think that BC could actually be a little bit better than people think. And the reason why is simple. They return essentially three all-conference offensive linemen. Mike Vrabel's son, Tyler Vrabel, is the left tackle. He's going to be a star, first, second-round pick type guy over the next couple of years. He's still young. Like, they basically – Hunter Long will be a first three-round draft pick at tight end. They basically, like, have a decent core to be a functional, like, we can beat you 20-17 type team. If Jerkovic, the quarterback from Notre Dame, gets eligible. If he doesn't, BC is going to be bad, because then they're back to starting to walk on and they're going to start that whole cycle again. But if with a quarterback in what would have to be some sort of offensive evolution to a more refined passing game than we saw at any time, pretty much since Ryan Day left that offense 4 or 5 years ago, I actually think there are some guts at BC. They return a ton of guys on defense. Like, so again, their defense was bad. I think it was 128 last year. You'd think Jeff Hafley could energize that scheme a little bit, and you got some guys back. I and they've taken some grad transfers. I think they can bolster that a little bit and surprise a couple of people. Their non-conference is generally pretty dreadful, with Kansas and Holy Cross. And again, they lost to Kansas at home last year. So anyway, that's my like local take there. Syracuse is interesting. They're like Tommy DeVito or bust at quarterback, basically. He obviously was the Elite 11 guy. They got out of Jersey and Texas A&M offered, and he was all excitement. He's really the only good quarterback that Dino Babers has recruited there. And if you would think Dino Babers, you would think he'd be able to recruit a ton of quarterbacks. He has the Jimmy Garoppolo pedigree, plays in a pass-friendly offense. You're indoors 7-8 games a year. But they really have struggled at that position. The big turning point there was Brock Purdy picked Iowa State over them. And since that point on, they thought they had a good shot at Purdy. They really just haven't been able to fill that. And DeVito's young enough where they've struggled to land a guy in the portal because they don't want to piss off slash scare off DeVito. And guys don't want to go and compete with the guy who the coach brought in. So they brought in Sterling Gilbert as the OC quarterback guy, which is essentially a huge upgrade from the quarterback coach who was essentially like a Babers in-law who got hired from the Houston area, Kirk Martin, and that didn't work out. DeVito didn't get any better. People in that program really think DeVito has the tools, and Babers has been very, very adamant about this since he recruited him to do that. But, like, you know, here's the thing is they've had very loud wins, and they had one 10-win season. But other than that, they've been pretty dreadful up there. So it'd be interesting to see. This is a big turning point year, because if it isn't, if DeVito's not the answer, they're really in trouble. Now, I'm not saying Babers is going to lose his job or anything like that. He's got a long, long contract and a lot of guaranteed money on it. But they could be at a little bit of an awkward crossroads. It's they've pushed all their eggs in the Tommy DeVito basket right now, and you do see some of the shine coming off the Baylor offense. 5-6 years ago, right, the tempo was the rage, and nobody knew how to stop it, and that has changed. You look at Tulsa was hot for a little while under Phillip Montgomery. They've cooled down. The Bryles acolytes have kind of bandied around different places to mix results, and so I'll be curious sort of what happens there. So neither of those are particular contenders, but I thought I would go through them. What do you think about Pitt, Pat? Do you think they could become the foil? I think defensively they've been super consistent. They haven't been able to find an answer at quarterback. Do you think they could end up being sort of that coastal gunpowder?
Yeah, maybe. You know, I mean, I look at them, and I think they have a chance. Also, you know, Miami's been fool's gold for so long, I kind of hesitate to jump in. But the two that kind of interest me are the ones that bring in the grad transfer quarterbacks, is Miami with Derek King,
sure, and
Duke with Chase Bryce from Clemson.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I think you put Chase Bryce in a David Cutcliffe offense, and you're going to get as much as you can out of him, and maybe it's enough to again be the second or third best team in the Coastal, and if things fall apart at North Carolina or Virginia Tech, maybe you somehow win the Coastal. Somebody different wins it every year. Why not Duke? And I'd say, you know, you throw a bunch of them in the hat in the Coastal and see who's going to end up winning 46-44 in double overtime on a Friday night, you know, that turns the whole division upside down. That league is nuts, but that's the only kind of intriguing unknown about the conference, because Clemson is the known and all that really matters. And it will remain that way, I think, throughout 2020. And I think we agree on that one.
Yeah, I think Wake Forest is always underrated, right? Like, yeah. I think they lose Jamie Newman, but I think if you really watch Sam Hartman early in his career there, he's perfectly functional. They have a big-time receiver in Sage Surratt. They get Boogie Basham back, who'll be a first-round pick, who's a defensive end there. Like, I really think this could end up being one of the better Wake teams during Clawson's time there. And I'm looking at a prediction here from CBS that says that they're going to go 2-6 in the ACC. I think there's just a better core there than that. And he's built them to be too consistent to have that much slippage.
Yeah, no, Clawson's a heck of a coach. He really is. Not necessarily working with a flush hand all the time. They got to replace a lot of people on offense, but that's his specialty, that's his baby. So play them, you know, overlook them at your own peril, I would say, for Wake Forest. So all right, that's a relatively semi-thorough overview of the ACC. We'll be back later in the week to look at another conference we haven't decided yet. We'll flip a coin 4 minutes before we start and go from there. That is if the world is still spinning. Remains very much to be seen. The Mayan calendar may have us all marked. And if so, then this is goodbye forever. You don't even have to leave a review, but just in case it's not the end of the world, leave us a review, say nice things. Thank you for listening, and we will talk to you later this week.
I'm Mike Lizikoff, Chief Investigative Correspondent for Yahoo News.
And I'm Dan Kleidman, Editor-in-Chief of Yahoo News.
We're the hosts of Skullduggery, a podcast that not only breaks down the news, but also breaks news.
We deliver authoritative analysis while drawing intriguing historical parallels from our decades of covering D.C. scandals.
With our current focus on the president and his administration's handling of the coronavirus, to the 2020 elections, we interview those helping to shape the stories.
So subscribe to and download Skullduggery wherever you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media at Skullduggery Pod.